Good evening, everyone. Hello. Hi. My name is Karen Giussone, and I'm the Helen Bernstein Librarian for Periodicals, and it's a real treat to welcome you to the library this evening, to the Periodicals Room, to Periodically Speaking, which we're beginning tonight for three events. We have April 12th tonight, the next one will be May 10th, and then June 14th. And we're doing something a little bit special. The library is celebrating its centennial this spring. So we're going to take these three programs and sort of look back, forward, and present with a variety of different literary magazines and talk about change, adaptability, sustainability, continuity, influences, journals that influence other journals. And tonight, we're starting out with a program called The Little Magazine, Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. And we're featuring two wonderful magazines from the current periodical collection. Super Machine, which is in issue 3, so it's a relatively recent journal, and 6x6, which has been publishing since 2000. So that's the story. Thank you so much for coming. I want to thank CLMP, Jeffrey, and Tasha Sorensen for being so great to collaborate with. Also, this is our first multimedia event here in the Periodicals Room, so thank you guys for kind of gently pushing us forward. Thank you for coming. Enjoy the night. And now Jeffrey Leppendorf is going to introduce the program. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you all for coming out on this soggy spring night. Nice to see you all. Just a couple words about CLMP, the Council of Literary Magazines and Presses, for those of you who may never have heard of CLMP. We were started in 1967 by a group of little magazine editors, George Plimpton, Russell Banks, who back then had not yet written a novel but was a little magazine editor, and several others, to help independent literary publishers through the business of publishing. So we're a technical assistance provider. And we're thrilled to be doing this series at the New York Public Library, and particularly launching another series now in celebration of the centenary of the library. This is an incredible place to come for many reasons, but in particular to explore the literary magazine collections here, which are really fantastic. And as you've heard me say before, if you've been to one of these before, if you find a literary magazine that speaks to you, please subscribe to it. That's how they keep publishing. Two wonderful ones today. One that still seems new to me, but is already well-established, which is 6x6, along with Ugly Duckling Press. We have the founder and publisher here, editor Matvey Yankelevich, himself a poet and also a noted translator, and Ben Fama, founding editor of Super Machine, which, as you heard, is now in its third issue. And I have to say, I was just perusing together the first three issues, which you can look at on the back counter there, and I noticed that each one seems to have nearly doubled in size, which means that if all of you do support it, by issue 12, it should be really gigantic, really, really gigantic, and soon probably too large to even hold, and they'll probably have to supply a special device for you to roll it around, which would be nice. What else do I have to tell you? I do have to quickly say one other thing. There are tiny pencils in front of you and survey forms. Those little pencils are your keepsake souvenir of this evening. Treasure them, write poems with them. But please, before you leave with them, do take a moment and fill out the questionnaire. I do want to acknowledge our funders, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Axe Houghton Foundation, and the New York State the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs. They make it possible for us to present free programs like this, and what they get back out of it, and the reason they will keep funding it, is your feedback. So please take a moment to fill out the simple little survey. It really does help us in our future applications for funding. So thank you for that in advance. And now, without further ado, we're going to start with Ben Fama from Super Machine. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Thanks, everybody, for coming. It is a soggy night. So if you're not familiar with Super Machine, to take it all the way back, I guess it really started as the name of a bicycle that I had when I was really into bicycle activism. It was a tall bike. I was living in Virginia, and I started writing this zine called Super Machine, mostly because I met this author named Carl Watson that was in town to do a reading. And he's part of the New York group called The Unbearables that also involves Jim Feast and Jill Rapoport and I'm blanking on the other name right now. But they came down and did a reading in Virginia where I was living, and so I started writing this zine called Super Machine, and then years later moved to Brooklyn. I was living in the Bed-Stuy area, and I found Outpost Lounge and started a reading series there. So, of course, I had to use the name Super Machine. And then about a year later, we started to do a journal. And this is the cover of issue number one. It came out in March of just 2010. It was a cover done by Baltimore artist Sydney Pink, who I've actually never met, but it was sufficiently creepy enough for the first one. Well, this is our third controversial cover done by an artist named Sarah Everton. We always do parties when we launch the journal. This is a picture of McGregor reading at a great loft space out in Bushwick. McGregor's going to be reading for us today also with Dorothy Alasky and Karina Kopp. These are flyers that we did for the reading series. That still goes on today at Outpost. You can see this is Dorothy's flyer with Paul Killebrew and Laura Solomon. This is one that I made when Josh Beckman and the Waves book tour was coming through town. They had a free night before they read at the Lillian Vernon House, so they asked me to if I could host them, and I did. And you can see it's so old, the website is still a blog. This is the cover of our second issue. We did a fundraiser dinner a while back to raise some money for the second issue at a private residence with his cook. It was really great. Ben Mirov read with McGregor Card and Jocelyn Spar and Bianca Stone read. It was very spooky. And this is another picture of the fundraiser dinner that we did. This is another flyer. And this is another flyer featuring Karina Kopp, who I'm not sure is here yet. We started doing chapbooks in the fall, and Christiane Riddle's Revenge Poems was the first chapbook that we did. And back to number one. So our fourth issue is going to be out September 10th, which is kind of the Brooklyn Book Festival and also the beginning of Fashion Week. So two good reasons to pick that date, I thought. So I guess that kind of sums up where Super Machine is at. So I guess now I could turn it over to Mafe. He's going to talk about Ugly Duckling.
Thanks. Thank you, Ben. Actually, I'm going to talk about 6x6 rather than Ugly Duckling. Although we did, when we started 6x6 in 2000, we put for whatever reason, Ugly Duckling was still a very nascent press. We put a publication of Ugly Duckling Press, and we were using that name, Ugly Duckling, on all these random chapbooks and some other periodical publications until it coalesced into actually printing books. So we were just using that as a unifying name. Here we go. So I guess what I'll show you, let's see if we can get this to work. Not very good with working with this PC, but maybe I can unzoom. Okay, there we go. this is issue number one. The idea of the of 6x6 magazine, if you're not familiar with it, is that there are six poets in each issue, and each poet has six pages. Therefore, it is called 6x6. I will get another picture, which will explain. Let me see if I can actually. Well, that doesn't really explain, but it's kind of cool. Let me get all of these. Hold on. So. So 6x6 started in 2000 with a group of four people, myself included, and Greg Ford, Julian Poirier, and Philip Marinovich, all poets. I was a beginning reader of poetry, of contemporary American poetry, and 6x6 was, in a way, my first real venture into the land of what was going on in contemporary American poetry, which before that, in some time in college and after, I had thought was totally dead, until I met Greg, Philip, and Julian, who told me otherwise and showed me lots of interesting editions and magazines. And so, because in college, all I had access to was sort of mainstream stuff. Let me see if I can... No, that's not going to work. Pause. Okay. That works, sort of. Though it's hard to see that. Anyway. I'm going to talk about that a little later. But what am I looking for? So 6x6, we were thinking about how to start a magazine. When we met, we were all none of us were really publishing that much except our own zines. And I had done also, like Ben, a zine. I had done a zine called Ugly Duckling in the early 90s and had been continuing to do that when I moved to New York. Basically, we didn't know where to publish, and we didn't know why we should publish in very large journals where your name would appear among hundreds of other names, or 50 or 100 other names. And we thought, wouldn't it be nice to have a very small, sort of manageable number of writers? And also, for me, it was a really great thing because then I could sort of concentrate on six people's work at a time and think about their work in a slightly larger span of pages than would normally be allotted in some of the larger magazines. And also, it was, I'll show you issue number one. Is here, and there's also issues in the back. This is number one. It was also kind of based in zine and DIY traditions, and we didn't have money for, we basically just set it up in the way that the four editors would take $250 or something around that every time we needed to an issue out of their paychecks, and we would put that together and laser print just at home, I think, or somebody's printer, the insides and pay for the cover to be done at a small shop. And I think that's where we offset, I think, the insides for number one, and then collated it ourselves and cut the corners ourselves, et cetera. The whole design comes sort of, is inspired by this 1914 futurist magazine called Tango with Cows, which is really a one-author edition. Vasily Kamensky wrote all the poems, but the Bourlouc brothers did a lot of drawings inside, and it was printed on wallpaper. Let me see if I have... This is one of the pages with Kamensky's ferro concrete poems, 1914. This one is about a telephone number. So we had this idea of a small number of poets. Julian was using dice at that time to determine certain chance operations with his poetry. So we thought sick at first. I think he said four, and then I was like, well, what about the dice? Let's just call it 6x6, and then we can have six poets in each issue with six pages, and that gives them more room. And then the cut, the magazine is actually 7x7 in dimension, but the cut, we think of the cut as taking away enough area for it to be 6x6 inches. We used a rubber band to bind it because we were cheap and had no funding. And because it was also connected to, it added, just like the hand cutting of the corner, which we still do by hand on each copy, each of 1,000 or so copies, that sort of added this sense of someone actually
dealing with the physical object by hand, the editors being actually involved in the production. And that was sort of much like what it was like to print a futurist magazine in 1914 for Vasily Kamensky. He would have been involved in typography, would have been involved in choosing how it would look, etc. The great thing about the Tango with Cows is that it's published on printed on wallpaper, which we actually did for number 6 because we were so happy we got to number 6. And now every 6th issue, we do some kind of homage to the wallpaper feeling, whether it puts some kind of patterning or because actually printing on wallpaper is really difficult, especially if it's vinyl 70s wallpaper and the ink smears off. And then you have to spray it with fixative. And I remember my living room was like a factory that week. Or I think it might have taken longer than a week. I don't know. Ryan probably remembers. But anyway, so that's basically the story of 6x6. I don't know. In a nutshell, we started with this idea, and we started to get going. And now we think we're going to go to 36 issues and complete the project. We are now at issue number 22, and I'll just quickly, before I go back to this, actually, I'll go through the issues in a moment. Since I have this here and it's up, I'm going to go through this little slideshow I thought of. So, I was thinking about, well, where did little magazines start? And, of course, they started with The Germ. Here it is. Thoughts towards nature in poetry, literature, and art, which is around 1850. Yeah, is that right? Of course, The Germ was the pre-Raphaelite magazine. They only lasted 4 issues, I believe, and they changed the name of the magazine from The Germ to just something like poetry, literature, and art, or art, literature, and poetry, because The Germ didn't make sense to anyone. So that title actually only lasted 2 issues, I think. And I was thinking, oh, so here's one of the Rossetti brothers. I think that's Michael William. I had another picture of, but this is all out of order. Well, this is another editor of The Germ. This is McGregor Card, and he edited a different Germ, and that came out in the late 90s, around the time we were starting to think of 6x6, but this was already around. This was a big inspiration for all small pressers in the 90s. This is which issue? This is number 2. McGregor Card reinstated, and with Andrew Maxwell, brought The Germ back after 150 years almost. And I think there's a slight resemblance actually between him and this fellow. This is Gabriel Dante Rossetti, it's GD, right? Sorry, Dante Gabriel, is it? Okay. Rossetti. This is his brother. Okay, so this is Margaret Anderson, right? I got her confused for a second with Margaret Randall, who did the El Corne Emplumado. This is the editor of the Little Review, which I now think of as the inspiration for magazines such as Fence magazine and other little magazines that exist today. This is actually her friends, Jane Heap on the left, Mina Loy, and Ezra Pound. Oh, I wish I could make that bigger. Is there any way to do that? Well, anyway, we'll have to deal with. And they did the Little Review, which is a magazine of the arts making no compromise with the public taste. It was also subtitled an International Journal of Arts and Letters. They did an Exiles issue. This is actually a flyer of Van Doesburg, but I thought of the triangles echoed with 6x6. But this was all happening around the time of the Russian Futurist thing, and these productions are incredibly ephemeral. And I really like that connection of 6x6 to the ephemerality of modernist little mags, not like the history of the dial, let's say, but rather these tiny publications that really published some of the greats of that time for the first time. Like, they were publishing Joyce, they got into a lot of trouble over the Molly Log, and so forth. And they made no compromise with the public taste. And that's what I'm hoping that our little magazine, Super Machine, and 6x6 can do. So now that I've done my pathetic little slideshow, I was going to show you these images. Of course, you know, the Rossettis through the Germ influenced William Morris, who, and I showed you the Craftsman thing, who influenced the Arts and Crafts movement. So that was this other direction in modernism that I think was also very important to note. On one hand, you have the fine printing. On the other hand, you have sort of futurist, this sort of the kind of guerrilla tactics that that Super Machine perhaps employs in their incredible events and very fervent events planning, programming, readings, and all of this commotion around Super Machine that is not to be dismissed as something just publicity. It's actually part and parcel of a little magazine, I think. Its activity is not just publishing, it's also everything around the magazine that can get people involved. This is number two. Oh, I need to explain. So Say the Words, Pickle Time is not the title of the magazine, obviously. The title of the magazine is still 6x6, but each time we decided that instead of the title of the magazine, we would employ the first line of the first poem as a kind of intro, as a title for each issue. And we use the same, we still use the same same letters, same font for the typeface that we found in a book, Xeroxed, for the numbering. Usually we did it in rubber stamp at first, then later in letterpress, like here, and this was actually a issue that came out just around September 2011, and that was very strange. But anyway, this is a line from Anna Muscovacus. This is a line from Frank Lima, who was in this issue, and this issue suffered a fire. This came out in December 2011, and then promptly in the spring of 2012, Julian and Greg had a fire in their apartment, in which, among other things like artworks that burned, was most of the run of number 5, which had Keith Waldrop, you know, National Poetry awardee, Philip Nikolaev, Beth Murray, Frank Lima, Mariana Ruiz Fermat, and Micah Ballard. It's a great issue, and it hardly saw the light of day. It just kind of disintegrated. So there's number 6 in a different wallpaper. And that's, I can't even remember who that is, whose line that is. I think this is a line by Erica Weitzman. And so I'll just scroll through them, and then we'll start with our poets. I think I mentioned everything I needed to mention. So it comes out 3 times a year. It's always open to submissions. We have free copies in the back of 6x6. These are review copies of the last 3 issues. And also our catalog for Ugly Duckling Press. So the press does not only 6x6, but 6x6 is a very important thing for Ugly Duckling, because it's sort of the way we find new people. The editorial board of 6x6 keeps rotating. I'm still on it, and Greg's still on it, but other people join up. Now we have, intermittently, we have other editors sort of making this thing happen and choosing the poets. So we get a lot of unsolicited submissions, and that's mostly what we choose from, which is great. And then we go on to work on chapbooks, so sort of like Super Machine does, to work on chapbooks and books in with those authors that we've found through 6x6. This is another multiple of 6, so we did the patterning thing to reference Kamensky's wallpaper. And here we are coming up on, at 21 we were able to go to a bar, and then 22, this is where we are currently, and number 23 is coming out in the in about 3 weeks. So with that, I'm going to invite Ben back up, and he's going to introduce some of our writers, some people who were in 6x6 and Super Machine. Yeah? Okay. So thank you.
Thank you, Babe. So Dorothy Lasky is shared by both 6x6 and Super Machine. She's the author of two full-length collections of poetry, Awe and Black Life. She's the author of the chapbook, Poetry is Not a Project, out on Ugly Duckling Press. She researches creativity and education at the University of Pennsylvania and teaches poetry at NYU and lives in New York City. So please help me welcome Dorothy Lasky.
I hope you all are doing well. I picked two poems representing the two journals that we just talked about. So the first one was in 6x6. I just remembered by looking at your beautiful slideshow that it was in number 9. But I remember when I got my acceptance letter for 6x6, I was so excited, and it was for this poem. This poem is called The Red Rose Girls. Does anybody know who the Red Rose Girls are? Yeah? Oh, do you want to tell us? Or? Yeah, that's a great book. I forget all their names, but basically it was three visual artists and writers, and one of them worked for Harper's, which you can see represented up there. And they lived together and trying to not shirk their domestic duties, but just live together and kind of supported each other in their artwork. So this is called The Red Rose Girls. 1. The Red Rose Girls were unlikely girls. HD liked them anyway, and they spent their time in the insides growing soft. Inside they were all mush and roses rotting, and when people spoke to them, their insides wilted from the inside and not from the outside, which as it was bright and blue and plastic. 2. There was a time the Red Rose Girls went into death, and death was untuned to them, and he made them an unlikely hole to hide themselves from anything. And the place they hid was mathematics and really was nothing, and also was its lesser art, astrology, which of course is everything. And in math and astrology, their heads burst out of the dragon, like an unlikely pair of dragons, one with half a leg and the other untuned and slightly bumpy. 3. The Red Rose Girls went out to sit on the beach, and Wolf was there, her arms outstretched, and into them they went. She was their lost daughter, and kissing her arms extensively, she was bat-like, and her arms outstretched, a great many oceans, and they were all sisters, kissing the arms of a great eternity, too large to even be compared to things that are small, and the picture they have of that day is on the dresser. 4. The Red Rose Girls told the day anything, for there is nothing the day can't handle. It's bright smart being the way hell out of war and marriage. They got their way out of war and marriage, those devilish leopards, cancering and in them, the folds of the great bat, unlikely and mean. 5. I am finally in the Red Rose Girls and mean. I mean to say, I am in the girls and mean and can't get out, the place of me not mean and unstartled, and unlikely to be the rose all bunched up. In it, its core is a universe of cats, and inside the universe is the scary sound of cats, their heartbeats and hoofbeats making a universal mistake. 6. We, the Red Rose Girls, have made a serious mistake. The universe is unlikely. Our hearts are sore. The roses... Our heads are folding over like the bats with wings outstretched, and in the brain is a wing, and unlikely that, a graph of Europe and the grisly arts made by the machine men, their little metal hearts, elephant-like and supple. And then I'm just going to read one last poem. I think I have time, right? Okay. And this is a poem that was in Super Machine 2. It's called Death and Sylvia Plath. My student in the City College really likes the poems of Sylvia Plath. She is writing her research paper about Lady Lazarus. I like this student. She spends some time leaning over me and telling me how in the poem, Plath turns from an object into an entertainer and finally into a demon. Oh, yes, you are right, I tell her. We are pleased. I wonder afterwards, why do young women like Sylvia Plath? Why doesn't everyone? The student tells me that when she was young, she liked Plath. I did too. I did not ride horses. Sylvia Plath rode horses. I don't have a thesis. I don't have a structure. I am a demon. There are blue streaks in the sky. It is spring. I am not you, nor do I want to be. If I did, I would not write this poem. It is 2/21 on 2/21/2010. I am not alive. No, I am no longer breathing. I don't live in this world. I already live in the other one. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dottie. Next, we're going to be hearing from McGregor Card, who we've already seen two pictures of. McGregor Card lives in Queens, teaches at Pratt Institute, and programs the Monday Night Reading Series at the Poetry Project. A new chapbook, The Archers, is just out from Song Cave. His first full collection, Duties of an English Foreign Secretary, was published in December 2009 by Finch Books. From 1997 to 2005, he co-edited The Germ, a journal of poetic research, with Andrew Maxwell. So please help me welcome McGregor Card.
I'm in the middle of finishing, and I'm not an Italian speaker, so forgive the translation. Use the mic? Okay. The mic. It's a big room. Oh, and it's recording. Hi. Poem. I don't want a view of the coast, or the permanent coast. I can live. I'm adult. Or in and among those adults, I'll be gone to a station at night, crawl under the groin of a monk and live, a tannic spirit and no property at dusk. I don't want a view of the permanent groin. In a sense, I don't want to improve. I have a lead foot on the positive flute. I belong to a transit authority. I have a lead foot on the adequate flute. I improve to the love of community, floored by an oak that's not even satanic and quiet, but possibly there. It's not far to love, but it's travel, and travel is great. You remain, like an oak that remains to get bent and broadly remains. Give it time. There's no choice in a way. Not at all. I can live above ground. I'm in love with a transit sorority, edit the groin of a monk and die. I host the medical dusk. I moan by force. My goblin hair is homosexual and gold, all counterfeit and blowing in the speed. Some hum, some hum, some hum, some hum. So hum along with them together. Some hum along, some moan, some really moan. Don't all moan along with them at once. Not necessarily. First think about how much that fucking rule. Ready, passionate submission to executive command for necessary choral moaning can and will consolidate mere satanic authority. Satanic power is administrative. Heretics return to ordinary profanation are submitted to a dark, unwitting forfeiture. Video Lord Satan worship, rickrolled to Pauline, erect and standing, Jesus Christ the Nazarene. Necessary choral moaning can and will improve the managerial sufficiency of fucking, rickrolled to the managerial sufficiency of fucking Christian orthodoxy. Pronto, appassionata sotto missione ad un ordine esecutivo obbligatorio per una corale lamentela può e deve consolidare mer autorità satanico. Il potere satanico è amministrativo. Eretici tornati a ordinari profanazione sono destinati a brillante involontaria decadenza. Adoro in video mia signore Satana Rickrolled alla Chiesa Paolina, eretto e permanenti. Gesù Cristo, il Nazareno, un ordine esecutivo obbligatorio per una corale lamentela può e deve migliorare la sofficienza manageria del caso Rickrolled alla sufficienza.
That's just because I couldn't pronounce the Italian.
And then I'll read one more. It's called Spasmodic I'll read one more. It's called Spasmodic Tragedy, and it's for Philip Marinovich. I feel community and peak all over my community, but fear an anthem coming. How far is it to beat your rattle to a friend that registers a sound to kind of land? How far to count? I worry we agree how far to count before we sing the country hit, the heat of friendship, on a technicality. I want to be alone is unavoidable, in fact, but first, I want to be so ratified to be alone on three. All of us excite me in particular. Those of us are still, in fact, alive. All of us, in fact. To show we feel invited by consensus to a private recitation, please be seated, will be seated, with an imitative rattle in the country. Do you feel or meet your company? How many of them could you fail to beat your rattle in the country? Even justice long in coming as a country, even pride of indignation shared across a ground that designates a ground of friendship, even the most agitated choir is a country by the wicked technicality of unison. I want to make the touch, but never hold the burn to be a trial warning or a brand or say to bring a lesson to a crowd. I fear community, unregistered and warm, but fear an anthem coming. Feel I need I first. I know it doesn't feel I need I first. I fend, I carry on, I fend, I cause, I fear, I fend, I knock, I carry on, another knock. I fear I knock into a friend in line. I feel I know another carry on. I feel in line. I feel like fourth or fifth in line. I not the friend I feel out, not the line I fill, or feel I knock into another friend. I feel out nine. I knock into a friend, okay? I knock into a floor I feel I need, okay? I want, I know, I floor, a friend I need. I knock into a floor, a friend I feel I need and fear. I cause, I fear, I fend. I cause, I fear, I fend, I carry on. I feel I carry on okay. I fend, I know, I fend. I fend, I fend, I fend, 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 fend. Thank you so much. And thank you to Ben and to Mako.
Our last reader tonight will be Corina Kopp. Afterwards, we're going to have a conversation with all of us, authors and Ben and myself, and then we'll have maybe time for one or two questions from the audience. Corina Kopp is a playwright and poet. She lives in Brooklyn and has been all over the place and is now... has just finished the MFA program at Brooklyn College in playwriting with the esteemed Mack Wellman and others. She is the author of essays on Jean Day and Hannah Wiener, and texts of hers can be found in Cannot Exist, The Brooklyn Rail, Super Machine, of course, Denver Quarterly, Fence, Aufgabe, and also in 6x6. She is the author of a few chapbooks, and actually one of them is coming out from Ugly Duckling Press in the summer. So we're really excited to be working with Corey again after a long break, since I don't remember what issue that was. Number 14, wow, that feels like a long time. And she was also recently the editor, I think she just did her last issue after 2 years of being the editor of the Poetry Project newsletter. So... please welcome Corey Kopp to the stage, front of the room.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me. It's hard to follow two of my best friends, but I'm being cheesy. Okay. Oh, actually, is this the one you poured? This is a, you can hear me okay? Yeah. This is a new poem as well. It is being written still, and loosely inspired by a symposium that McGregor and I went to, and his wife Megan, based on the non-philosophy of Francois Laruelle. I should direct you to McGregor to talk more about that non-philosophy. Loosely inspired. Anyway. Magenta, what else? Antagonist, never let go, never be the house, hold perfect soil and ideal climate, be a love that does not know how to know, human genre crashed on the purblind sea, however austerely sunsick I made hares and eggs, enraptured, trundled, one of my reveries, even amidst a violet party, decision to help force a whale under the point of the green pencil, it will like pulsing. I don't, but how to achieve purblind, handcrafting raw product at the hop. Knew one person in the lush room, a block from Feltley Hats, a business down the street in lilac, hesitation, pro room, where two more I knew enter the skin of the skate, late and married swans, absent a stretch, otherwise next step, religious escort promises, get the welcome, naturally fetishized, and faith, was it foul? A dullery glass, I believe in fantasy, not resigning to pilot attested water, Easter spirit, three joyful leaps, filleted in plaid, a prisoner's skyscape and air conditioning made by illumined petal shorts, oh delicate hands, finish fat with little time for incredible tea, legs in golden lotus supine, carefully throw the meal down hair pie road, dad's vital light hand against Palinopsia fish tank, no, L-E-S, Orchard Street, inside, mind acetylene, I think I feel the visible beams cut, I learnt mother on my watch in the room, pears are bad, lead to the place and the wall cooing. Unless 100 pale heads and sticky shit split and form a cloud of dust, in the drawing I see mallard and I see my liege, leitmotif, allergent, I see my gentle, it's an agent, is coloring her lips in with this color. Agent is six now and his coloring book is Art Nouveau Figurative Designs by Alphonse Marie Mouka Jr. and he is filling in the fall and winter lips with magenta. No coarse cloth in attendance synonymous, small Tahitian grave. Let rest here my lyre, and here soon the moon's fair lecture in black, so I stay tonight. Preheated saucepans in seats, sorry, a group of philosophers. In my many books, opacity no longer hides. Novice, blankly, always hold up. She's a miraculous, fast. Her ribs go, 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 that they rift in 1984, rib clone lives without life, vacant god prattles, lets a tricycle's 2-inch steel tube slam into a hymen, all left feet to do, I cry. Hey, novice, my day starts at 3, swill, and event culture starts at 7. My eyelid in the room begins to sacrificially tremble. My nose knew not, I, a small flower sachet, weakening in deciphering a twit, a measurement of nothing. NB Spare Hill. Transition metal. I have no physiological control, madrigal, ever. And assuming a rapid movement, the slap from baker to her biscuit is a turning good. Public might think of nerves or heart flip at first on-screen locomotive, and so then luminal, and then interconnected pastries. I admit only my sunk agency. Cornstalk, two cobs, boil. After the symposium banged out sugar, the author on using heresy to mutate sufficiency's going form stood before my indifferent lid, now aging me to, oh, delicate hands, constantly refer to and understand each other in a bind. We should say what we think the man thinks while seated next to the man himself or sleep in the room next to her hand releases glass, her shoot-up approach to alterity changes. Hers habits, hers work, we write, is non-axiomatic, fearsome now, making grace contingent on presence, a graceful, insecure curette. I made this for you, eat it. Hair and smoke appears woven in a beyond slot cut when I worry those people aren't talking. Desire beneath the garbage men is April rain, hard, particle o'er mountain or through mountain as eminence, bald, red, hot pits are facts. Dad's light sponge, I bet, for safe simultaneity. My pampering so finally a fire, analog witch, make a special effort and wipe up this counter I practiced on. A row of chairs, or low, lively blueberry ship found to give unhappiness in case that says anything, fresh ribbon. Get up, don't stop, get up, in case. In France, they know what it's like, what another's feeling when feeling and foul was it. Faith stand next to their shoes, not in a peasant stabbed boot of the parting or businessman's loafer. Ta gueule, m'lady, parsley, fucker, in this sense, I want dead. He sorts a paper well and appears in dark silhouette behind deer standing alert in the moonlit night. It's just that the jelly taken from the whatever Frigidaire we swam down river was made by my grandmother, Doris, a girl called Doris? I said, no. Thanks.
So thank you, McGregor. Thank you, Dottie. Thank you, Corey, for reading. And I'm really glad you could all come out tonight. So we have some time for some questions. We have three mics, so three people can talk at the same time. Do you want to start with anything, Ben?
Yeah, I was wondering if, since you guys have been doing journals longer than me, I feel so new. If just talking about continuity of the little journal, or if you had any ideas about how things have changed, or how McGregor, since you did the germ and you've kind of had some time to step away from it, if you had any reflections on just the different climate of the little magazine.
Oh, I don't know if this is on. Is it okay though? It's just a switch. It's too advanced. Hello. Well, it's a very different context. You know, when the germ started, there was very little. There are a lot of magazines right now that one can publish in that are even, you know, whether or not they're perfect bound or they're sort of Mimeo, whatnot. There's a real crowd out there. When we started the germ, Oblique had finished. If you were writing a certain poetry, you know, a poetry that was coming out of the new American poetry tradition, whether that's Black Mountain or New York School or San Francisco Renaissance, there wasn't a lot out there. Oblique had folded. Clayton Eshelman's Sulphur had folded. There was an Apex of the M, a great magazine, little magazine, had folded. There were like two or three magazines that you might... Rattle Moon was Canadian, and actually that had just started, I think. Well, Lisa Robertson had one book out. This is like 95, actually, is when we started talking about it. So that's why we did a perfect bound journal. I don't know. When 6x6 came along, it was the most exciting, like by far the most exciting magazine that I'd encountered since moving to New York, and I've had the same experience with Super Machine, and I kind of was envious. Like, if we'd continued, we also had the same problem doing wallpaper covers. It's very difficult. Ouch. I mean, I don't know. The answer, I'll get off quicker, but
the
answers actually are really sort of mundane. I mean, the internet was very young. There was EPC, the Buffalo Poetics List, and Jacket, and very little else. Things were mail order. You had to... I don't know. You remember this time as well.
You remember it better, actually, because of my memory. No, because I really didn't get involved, and I was finding out about Oblique and stuff like that when it was already over.
Okay.
I wasn't, because you were a student of Peter Gizzi's, right? So you who edited Oblique, so maybe, you know, you were in where I went to school. It was like people talked about the New Yorker and didn't tell me that there were other kinds of magazines.
But it was very hermetic. I mean, it was really like a hermetic in a way that, you know, the shift in the cover from the Black Sparrow. I think of the shift in cover. This could be like a metaphor or an analogy. The shift in the cover of the Spicer collected books from that embossed without ink page with the tarot card to the, which is great too, that it Wesleyan Press put out the, it's wonderful, but there's a real sea change there. Like we would have, people would have died laughing if you said that was going to happen to Jack Spicer's collected works, that it was going to come out from Wesleyan, that he was going to have his face on the cover of American Poetry Review. I mean, this was a really, there really were two traditions that were entrenched against one another, and one had more access to, I think, to institutional funding, clout, power. I don't want to go
But on. It's interesting that you can't, I mean, Oblique was one of the few, and some of the, some university sponsored journals in the late 80s or early 90s that had a kind of perfect bound of solid feeling, maybe conjunctions, obviously, but a lot of the independent magazines were, like Apex of the M and others, were incredibly ephemeral, sort of following in the tradition of the Mimeo Revolution, examples of which you can see here at the library, at the Berg Collection. They had this wonderful show, Secret Location on the Lower East Side, back actually just after we started 6x6, probably sometime in the early 2000s. There was this great show of all the little magazines and ephemeral chapbooks and things that were being published down here. In the city in the six, sort of starting in the late 60s. But the magazines sort of in the late 90s took a really interesting turn, like Fence Magazine and The Germ. And what's the one that Brandon Downing edited?
Is it 96 or 6500?
6500.
6500,
yeah.
Right.
And other magazines started to look more like they wanted to compete with in professional appearance and the sort of solidity of a larger book form with established institutional journals and with university journals. And that hadn't really happened before. Before it was like really cool to be stapled because you acknowledged your marginality, like in the 80s, and you by doing this kind of ephemeral publication, I think poets were emphasizing their marginality in those culture wars. Right.
Oh, and I had, like, a couple things. Oblique, though, wasn't funded by a university.
I said one of the few.
Oh, one of the few. Yeah, one of the few that wasn't. Yeah, and that's exactly
like,
why.
Like
that,
a funded magazine.
Like, if I were to start a magazine today, I wouldn't care really necessarily to have a perfect bound journal that came out. It just seemed really needed at the necessary at the time.
Yeah, I agree.
Because a bookstore really was the way that people were going to get this. There wasn't the same web presence, so it was much more. It seemed much more important at the time when these three other major experimental, perfect bound experimental journals had collapsed. It just seemed like there was a vacuum, I totally agree.
I think it was a shift because you guys were some of the first to say we're going to occupy this space, and we're going to push. We're not going to just because it's cool to be stapled and like only have 100 copies. We're not going to do that because you guys thought it was important.
I love those magazines too.
But you also, of course, you do, and we all like came out of that. I think of loving that ephemeral stuff and that sort of romanticism with the marginal, but or the romance with the marginal. But it was interesting. It's interesting how the late '90s see this moment of like really solid, lots of Super Machine. Definitely, I think is influenced by that. Sort of tradition that came from the Germ and Vents and other journals that were very solidly occupying a space that, as you say, had been, you know, needed to be filled and to, you know, like 6x6 had the problem of distribution because no distributor would take a magazine that was rubber band bound with a cut corner. But for us, it was like this, like little, you know, we did 1,000 copies starting from the beginning, but it was we had to like work really hard to get them into people's hands, and we sold it very cheaply, like $2 and then $3. But that was sort of because 6x6 was its own very zine oriented thing, which was different, I think, from a lot of what, and because it only focused on six poets at a time, it was very different from a lot of the late 90s journals in that way.
Yeah, I guess it's interesting because I wanted to do Super Machine Perfect Bound and put an ISBN on it because I didn't want there to be any obstacles for bookstores to take it. I felt like there were enough obstacles to people who were doing this kind of writing, and the more exposure they could get would be better. Yeah.
No, we didn't even think, and we were like, this is what we can come up with, and we didn't realize we'd have so much trouble. You know?
We made this such a half-assed compromise. I just want to show something embarrassing. We were like, we'll have a perfect bound journal and a run of 1,000, and it'll have distribution, but we won't put a barcode on the back. That was like, I think our target, we chose the wrong target there. But again, what Motvay was saying, small press distribution had just stopped carrying chapbooks and chapbook journals. So that was another problem at the time, because that to have SPD distribution was really important, especially important back then, and they had just ceased doing that.
And we still don't. I mean, we just had to create a network of bookstores, which is a great way to do it, but it's increasingly hard, of course. But now there's more independent bookstores that are like, this thing looks cool, so we'll sell it because it's an odd shape or whatever, and even if they're not a poetry-oriented place. But which was part of our mission, to get this stuff into people who weren't necessarily going to read the big, thick journals, because you have to sort of know and want to do that. And 6x6 was more like something you could just read on the subway and take a chance on something really cheap. So that there was that other, you know, a different motive, perhaps. But we still don't have distribution. We still really rely on subscriptions and CLMP mag fairs to spread the word, and then people who submit sometimes subscribe, and also this sort of small network of independent bookstores that we've been cultivating over time is the way we can get it out there. But yeah, of course, it's like now that there's the web, which really in the late 90s, we didn't know how to deal with that.
And yet the germ went to the web at one point.
There's like an archive that's up, and it's a blog. Yeah.
Blogs are okay.
Blogs are cool, man. It's okay. Do you guys want to talk about what little magazine you published in first? Dottie, what was the first magazine you published in?
It was called Art Life. It was in California. I don't know if they're still publishing, but it was put together with fasteners, like three and a three-hole punch. It was very nice, but I was so excited because I think I was a junior in college, and it was the people called me, and it was like the best thing that ever happened to me. At that moment, I was almost as excited as when I found out I was going to be in 6x6.
You got a phone call acceptance? I should start doing that. I would never think to do that.
We want to publish your poem? Hello.
Well, it was like back in the day when you were put here, right?
How about you, Corey?
I had a short story published in a New Orleans magazine when I was in college, but the first poem might have been in Jim Burley's Cannot Have Your Ball Back. Can we have our ball back? Can we have your ball back? Yeah, you had. Yeah, I think. There we are. Yeah. And that was like the first internet magazine or something.
That was great.
And it was very comprehensive, I remember.
That magazine was amazing because it had like, it looked like it had been programmed in the 70s. It was like, it was amazing. It was like green screen, almost the look. And there were just a bunch of names up there, and you would just click on them. And that was sort of a novelty in a way. I mean, it was sort of like a Mimeo thing because it had no real like fancy design at all. Yeah. Jeffrey, we have a few minutes for questions. Eugene Ostashevsky had a question. He's in the audience. Be careful. So Eugene Ostashevsky asks, this is for the recording, whether the format of our magazines affects the way that the authors write for those magazines. Ben? How it affects what they write.
It's a problem that, on my end, because Super Machine is always the same size, and most people write in Word, which is wider than Super Machine is, so you always have to ask them to change things, and it's really hard to do, because I wouldn't want people to do that to me, but it just kind of one of the things you have to do. But I'm not really sure how, are you thinking like the formal like properties of the.
For example, Eugene says the length of the work. Does it?
Yeah, I was thinking about this too. I've decided after a lot of thinking about this that it doesn't affect it, because something like the Poetry Project newsletter could publish a really long poem because it's so big, whereas maybe a smaller size that would take up 12 pages, but it's only 2 pages in a bigger thing. So I don't think so.
I think in Super Machine there's a lot of fluctuation between short poems and longer pieces. In 6x6, we actually ask people in our submission guidelines to think about the space, but not necessarily like it's 6 pages so you have to have 6 poems, but rather to use the space in some interesting way, to use that amount of space, whether it's a selection from a larger work or a section of a longer poem or a longish poem or a series that doesn't have to break up into 6 equal parts. It can, and some people have done that. But I remember publishing like 20 little Brandon Downing pieces in 6 pages, and other, you know, various ways that those pages were broken. One time we flipped something because it had really long lines. But yeah, I agree with Ben Fama that actually I think it's really important for writers to think about where they want to publish and what is the space of that journal, because it's not going to be, since the days of sort of stapled, I mean, there's still Big Bell and there's like a couple other journals that are stapled 8.5 by 11. Sal Mimeo is still happening every once in a while, but most journals are not going to be 8.5 by 11, and certainly books are probably not going to be 8.5 by 11. So, and then there's the issue of the screen, and I think like journals like Triple Canopy are dealing with how does a work look on the screen and what will be the format. So I think often the fact that our printers take 8.5 by 11 paper is really just like a real, it becomes a problem for a lot of younger poets, I've noticed, because the lines aren't accommodatable in a book form, and they also aren't necessarily... You don't really necessarily change the shape of your poem unless you change the space of your writing space, your sort of the site of it, I think. So to me, it's interesting to write on square piece of paper or triangular piece of paper or whatever and see how that affects it. And similarly, I guess my answer would be that a journal kind of does affect it. And also the milieu of the journal, like who's in it and what other kind of writing is there might affect what you submit to that journal as opposed to a different journal. But that seems like... a truism, or like totally banal to say, but nonetheless. Yes, in fact, it was so banal, I was struck by lightning. Adam Tobin, the owner and operator of Unnameable Books, has graced us. A great bookstore in Brooklyn on Vanderbilt. Should visit. Adam Tobin is asking whether what the effect of zine culture was on our magazines, but also what... Yeah. So Adam asked us to talk about zine culture in the earlier 90s. This is basically what you're talking about. Yeah, okay. Just wanted to get it for the record. Is zine culture relevant to what we're doing? It is relevant to how we started, definitely.
I think it's relevant to the general aesthetic strategy that Super Machine might have. I guess I'm thinking of our newest cover as something that I think of as not something you would usually see on a magazine.
It's not very literary. It's like skate zine culture.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to show anyone that was in it until it was already out because I thought they might rescind their submission.
um, I, you know, when I did the Ugly Duckling zine, it was sort of part of it was like a Dada zine, not so much a fan zine or blog or like kind of a like things like My Pathetic Life or blog zine, basically zines that would now be blogs where people talked about their lives or their bad jobs or their travels in a van or whatever. And those zines are kind of amazing. Those are some of my favorites from that period. But then there were also like music fanzines, which so when I took my zine to a store in the East Village that sold zines, they said that they didn't want it because it wasn't affiliated with a band and it didn't have any narrative. So, but there was a zine culture that was like lost, all the stuff that John M. Bennett does still does, but did especially in the 90s out in Ohio, and like a whole crew around, especially around visual poetry, that was very oriented towards the zine as a form. And that was really important to me, that when I started to see that in the, it's still around in the mid-90s very strongly. And those were some of the people that I traded zines with back then. And the zine, I think, directly led to, in fact, the rubber band was stolen from, and 6x6 was stolen from a zine called... I can't remember, but it was from Texas, and it was a lot about traveling and kind of traveling around the states and driving around, and it was just very narrative, but it was bound with a rubber band. I feel like zines, some of them have become blogs, but I think there's still like, and especially there's still a zine culture that's now using letterpress that's really amazing. Like at Quimby's, you see, in Chicago, you see so much good new stuff that's still sticking to print as a medium instead of going to the blog. I think for a lot of people, the impulse to do a zine has shifted. So younger people who would have done a zine in the 90s are now doing a blog. But to me, it seems like there's a really interesting thing about keeping it in print and using obsolete technologies, whether it's photocopy or letterpress, or, you know, there are zines that are letterpressed all the way through. And I think those are really amazing endeavors. Because they somehow combine this, like, very ephemeral. But it's always about, like, kind of, usually those zines are about, like, everyday life, but they're done, like, they're handset. So every letter is, like, such a labor, you know. You guys want to talk about zines? Zines? Did zines affect you guys?
Should we do one more question?
And you do about 1,000 copies, yeah?
Right.
They end up, through the CLMP Lit Mag fairs, they end up all around the country where they're donated, actually, so they're not making us money, but they do get out to a lot of people interested in small magazines, and they usually benefit some local charity in those cities, which is really great. But they end up, like, we get submissions from all over the country and even Europe. So I don't know how, but they get there. And I think it's over time, you know, like subscribers from all over the country, even places where they don't have little independent bookstores like Adams Unnameable to go to, or St. Mark's or something, still get the magazine. And now it's so much easier with the internet. I don't think we would have had so much circulation if it weren't for selling it through the web. People subscribe that way, find out about it that way. But they end up pretty much everywhere, and they also end up we send them as donations to prisons. We send them, then there are libraries that subscribe, and also like here at NYPL, they're here at periodicals. In the research library, but also they may be in some of the circulating branches as well. But they're certainly at other libraries around the states. But that's a slow process. I mean, the first issue, we were like going to readings and handing them to people and being like, this is something new, blah, blah, blah. But a lot of people found them. Ryan Haley found them at St. Mark's or at that little bookstore that was a Tonic. Oh, Gotham.
Oh my God.
Yeah, where Wise Men Fish or whatever. So at Gotham Books, Ryan, who's now a dear friend,
that was how like I met Ryan, was through the fact that he found the magazine, and later we met through that kind of stuff. And now he's a librarian. So hopefully that means that 6x6 won't won't die out. Where are your copies?
Well, we're still... Where are they? Someone just ordered one from the Netherlands today, our first issue. That's pretty cool. They kind of circulate, I guess, all over the country. I try to give a lot to the contributors so they can give them to their friends. When we're still so new, a lot of people are still learning about us. You know, we've only had three. We rely a lot on, I'd say, the internet, probably.
But events also. And we did, too. We relied a lot on it, having events and bringing people to the magazine. But you also have distribution with Small Press Distribution, right?
Yeah, we're distributed through Small Press Distribution. And also, we did a Kickstarter fundraiser. And one of the rewards was you got a subscription. So we gained a lot of subscribers through that. And then also just through the internet. And also, we do so many events, we sell there. And that's where most of them get sold.
Yeah. One last question, I guess, because we have to wrap up for the library. George. That's a great question. So the question is about, for the record, the question is about whether how we see our journals moving into the digital age, whether they're inherently only print publications or whether they're going to have another life online. Is that right, Ben?
Just really quickly, I think that Super Machine will only just be in print, I think, because I like the physical object, and also I think for my mind to organize submissions, when I see them come into the inbox, I start thinking of it, and then they fully arrive to me as what the book is going to be like. And then eventually, you kind of just know when that's going to be done. And for the digital world, I have a relationship with it where I don't think I would be a good editor because it just seems too imminent to always be going, where I think if I did start doing something online, it would just have to be a constant stream rather than like you would launch something every 6 months. So I think for what Super Machine has grown to, it would have to be something different.
We're only going to have 36 issues, I think, and then we're going to try to do a big printed anthology, maybe in two like a big block. But probably we'll digitize all of it, because we've done that with a lot of our chapbooks that are out of print. So once 6x6 goes out of print, probably we'll have a digital way of viewing it that hopefully will keep some of the formal aspect intact. But it's probably not going to be a digital... there's no... Maybe the next project after 6x6, if we get there to 36 issues, then maybe the next project will be some sort of very different online, maybe like Ben says, something more instantaneous, and both more ephemeral and yet more accessible in the way that the web can be. But it's a really great question. I think magazines are struggling with that now, like how much content to put on the web or what's different about their print issue and their web issue or things like that. But this, you know, 6x6 is so print. Like it's just a thing. And the mystery of not having the title on the cover and stuff, that was all about enhancing this sort of mysterious object that you might find somewhere and making that experience one of discovering through mystery into the poems. So I guess that... Thank you, Karen.
Thank you, Karen and Jeffrey.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Thank you. Tasha.